You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Reloading for 2012.
The next step.
It's the start of the next round.
In 2012.
Be back next year, I'm sure.
2012.
What happens next?
We're going to flash forward this morning by looking back for just a moment. The promise of democracy for Arab nations that turned 2011 into an epical year of change will require a pivot in 2012 to achieve real reform, to match the pictures of brave protesters and the sound of fleeing dictators.
Let freedom ring. Let it ring.
The question is, does freedom ring like a bell in places like Egypt that have no real history of it?
I just don't know what will happen tomorrow, but it is certainly possible that thousands of armed thugs can intimidate tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of peaceful protesters.
To make everybody see, in order to fight the powers that be, fight the power.
Or is it a fight to the finish with an outcome uncertain, inconclusive, as in Bahrain?
So much tension in the air in Bahrain. It is just thick with tension and apprehension about the future.
Or Yemen.
Well, it sure looks like a civil war to me.
Fight the power.
The voice there of New York Times reporter and columnist Nicholas Kristof, who helped us to understand and frame these important questions about the future of the Middle East all through 2011. 2012, though, will present new challenges and require people to face difficult questions about the creation of real democratic institutions. Nicholas Kristof now joins us live to look ahead to what 2012 will mean for the Arab world. Nicholas, it's always great to talk to you. Good morning.
Good morning. I've unpacked my crystal ball here, although it's never working terribly well.
Well, forget the crystal ball for a moment. Which are you, a freedom ringer or a fight the power dude after your experiences in 2011?
Well, somewhere in between. I mean, I do think that there tend to be a lot of pressures for pluralism, for democratic change, but I also think it invariably tends to be just really messy. I covered the Indonesian revolution back in 1998 and, you know, watched that unfold. And I think that is in many ways pretty analogous to what is happening in a lot of places in the Middle East. And, you know, it was freedom did not ring very clearly. It took a long time, but there certainly was real progress. And today we're a lot better off for it.
And it took a long time in the United States. I mean, the United States had no history of democracy back in the 1700s. And, you know, it was well after the Civil War that democratic institutions of the kind we understand today were created, which, you know, is nearly 100 years. So our expectations about what's going on in Egypt need to be seen through that lens to a certain extent. How would you assess the difference between an Egypt, which seems to be moving forward with reform tentatively, and a Bahrain, which looks more like China, where there was an uprising and then it was quashed, or Syria, where there was an uprising and it appears that, you know, the scenario in Egypt is not going to happen in Damascus?
Well, I mean, I think one of the lessons of Arab Spring over the last year was that, in general, if a regime can rely upon its armed forces or some unit of that to shoot civilians, then in general, it'll stay in power. And there are some exceptions to that, like Libya and Syria may eventually prove to be an exception. But, you know, in general, courage and vision on the part of protesters really is not a match for machine guns. The people with machine guns, if they're willing to open fire, if Mubarak had been able to persuade the armed forces to just mow people down, then he would probably still be in power. And in Bahrain, the government has been willing to, to really use force. It hasn't massacred people in the scale of Syria, but it has been willing to use harsh force. That's one reason why Arab Spring did not succeed there.
Talking with Nicholas Kristof, columnist for our partner, The New York Times. You know, I've been speaking with some of my friends from Egypt who are based in Alexandria and old friends from my time living in Israel. And both of them describe that the Arab Spring has really revealed a bigger dynamic between secular military institutions and religious institutions that were held at bay by dictatorship, but are now coming into the electoral process. And they describe the situation in Egypt between the military and the Muslim Brothers to be exactly mirrored in Israel, with secular authorities inside Israel and religious political parties trying to dominate forces there. That was a fascinating comparison.
That's really interesting. I mean, and I think it is true that that is what we're seeing, precisely what we're seeing in Egypt increasingly. You know, that the focus for the last year was on a lot of these young, liberal, secular, English-speaking, university-educated protesters who were in Tahrir Square. And in retrospect, I wonder if I, as a journalist, and if we, as journalists generally, didn't focus a little bit too much on those people who were, I think a pretty small minority of the overall population, and not enough on the aspirations of the broader population in the villages and the smaller towns who were more allied with the Muslim Brotherhood. And indeed, I think that, you know, the next shoe to drop, or the tension, one of the defining tensions for this year, is going to be the expected upcoming clash at some point between the secular military and the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis. And not only a clash of visions, but really also just a clash of power. I mean, the military has its privileges. It has its ways of extracting money from the economy, and it wants to keep those.
And the U.S. had to explicitly enshrine tolerance in the U.S. Constitution to prevent dynamics that related to slavery and racial tensions that were well built into the history that settled the United States as a British colony. Similarly, in the 1920s, Turkey had to enshrine secularism as the prevailing notion in that country to proceed with democracy. How's that going to play out in a place like Egypt or Libya or Tunisia?
That is going to be one of the great questions for, not only for the next year, but for the next decade or so. And there are just a lot of mixed signals. In general, I think almost everybody pays lip service to the idea of tolerance and the Muslim Brotherhood, the Salafis. They, you know, when you interview them, they keep telling you how much they value the Christian population, how much they want Egypt's Christians to be a major part of the country. But then there will be some conflict, and there will be an accusation that Christians have, taken away some Muslim girl and are converting her to Christianity, and people will storm the church and, you know, burn it down, and then there'll be a rampage. These kinds of conflicts happen, and I think it's going to be. I think a lot of Christians in Egypt are really nervous about the future, really for that reason.
Well, one of the things that's happened really over the last year is I think your Twitter feed follower number has gone well over a million, and I think part of that is because your passion about being outraged over repression has continued unabated. And I think people rely on your voice as a sense of what's going on in places like Sudan and Indonesia and now the countries of the Arab Spring. But I'm thinking back to your experience in China and all the places you've been in the world. Though your outrage about repression has not changed, has your confidence in democratic institutions wavered at all in all of this experience going back to 1989?
I've certainly seen an awful lot of examples where democratic countries ended up doing catastrophic things. And indeed, you can argue that there are cases where a move from a firm dictator to especially a multi-ethnic state with a lot of tensions between those ethnicities that ended up creating, catastrophe. You can argue that Sri Lanka, for example, that the tensions between the Tamils and the Sinhalese in the context of a quasi-democracy ended up being catastrophic for Sri Lankans. But having said that, I still think that democracy, Winston Churchill had it right, that it's the worst form of government except for all the rest. And you think about China, and for all the benefits of democracy, of authoritarian rule there economically, it was also authoritarian rule that presided over and was the reason for the worst famine in world history. 30 million people dying. thing. And so I still have a very firm belief that not only is there sort of a strong pressure as people get more educated, as people develop middle class, as they become more cosmopolitan for more democratic systems, but that it also really does tend to resolve or alleviate a lot of the social problems that people face all over the world.
Well, Nicholas, Christoph, we're grateful you were willing to think out loud on such a big subject for us this morning. Nicholas Christoph, columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Have a great 2012, won't you?
Thank you. I will.
I'm David Remnick, host of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.